You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In an incredible six-year investigation, true crime writer and investigative journalist David McGrath tells the unbelievable story of one of the most prolific predators in American history. Wayne Chapman admitted to abusing 100 children over an eight-year span from 67 to 76. What the world could never have known is that Chapman did not act alone. He worked in concert with other serial predators, unbeknownst to parents and law enforcement. Chapman was suspected in multiple child murders and was a completely fixated abuser. McGrath lives the veil on Wayne Chapman and a child sex ring that operated in the area at the time in this incredible true story. The book that we're featuring this evening is Monster, The Life and Crimes of Wayne Chapman, with my special guest, journalist and author, David McGrath. Welcome to the program, and thank you for this interview, David McGrath.
Thank you so much, Dan. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to shed some light on a story that's, outside of a handful of people, is incredibly underreported. So thank you.
Thank you so much. This is an extraordinary tale, extraordinary investigation. Let's get to how you came to this. You write that one night you were up watching TV and you saw a documentary on HBO entitled Have You Seen Andy? By Melanie Perkins McLaughlin. Tell us what this documentary did for you, what it triggered, and what was its content. Tell us about this event.
Sure. I had grown up in the Boston area, and I had always been interested in books and going to the library every day, and that was sort of my safe haven, and, a sort of abusive household, which is not uncommon for the time. And I always wanted to do a book, and like most authors, my main problem was what subject would I do it on, and I saw this documentary late at night, during the night, where I was battling a brutal head cold, one of those, head in a vice, can't sleep kind of nights. My wife was pregnant, so she was having a rough time getting to sleep, and we were both just kind of awake. And, I saw the documentary that Melanie Perkins had made about her friend Andy, and, this young boy disappeared from a pool in Lawrence, Massachusetts, which was, 25, 30 minutes from where I grew up. This man who was the main suspect in the case had also been the main suspect in some other disappearances that were a little closer to home for me. And, I was just struck, Dan, by this man's, it was really his booking photo. I couldn't get past the fact of his vacant sort of look, just the utter lack of humanity in this man's face. And I couldn't get over it. I fell asleep around 4:35 that morning. I was up, very early Googling, pictures of this man. And, at first, Dan, I just said to myself, find out everything that you can know that's to be known about this man. And, I sort of set off that very day to, and I had no idea that I would ever put a word, on paper about anything to do with Wayne Chapman, but I knew that any human being who ever interacted with him had any sort of insight into him, I needed to know. And I the reason why your show is so popular and true crime shows are often, the most popular podcasts, on Apple or wherever, is really because people need to know why. I think that's our fascination with crimes like this, is because they just need to know why. And I'm no different. I just needed to know why and how Wayne Chapman came to be. And, that was 2013, and here we are, in late 2021. And, you know, the book's ready to come out. And I still feel like, Dan, there's so much more to know. But that's the genesis of this book.
You write that once you knew you had to write this book, once you felt compelled, you had to start at the very beginning, and you started in Jamestown, New York, and visited Wayne Chapman's childhood home. What did you find out about Wayne Chapman and his childhood? Tell us what you found.
Well, I initially took off to Jamestown in late 2013 and worked with a woman at the Historical Society named Ashley Sensky, who was incredibly helpful, pointing me in the right direction. And, you know, when I got there, I had grown up in the city, you know, in housing projects, not far from Fenway Park in Boston. I had never really been to upstate New York, and I found it to be a town that, you know, nothing really happened in. You know, I would ask people on the street, you know, what happens here in Jamestown, and the most prevailing answer was nothing. It's just a random town that, you know, even the people who live here, it's completely forgettable. But, you know, I had the preconceived notion that Chapman would come from some sort of, you know, incestuous, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre type family, you know. Mm-hmm. And that really wasn't the case. Much like myself, his father was a military man who had been injured in Guadalcanal and had fought valiantly and been recognized for that by the United States Marine Corps. His father was a member of the 1st Marine Division, which my father was a member of. So, you know, there was nothing in his background with his parents that would indicate that he was ever sexually abused. Wayne Chapman was the firstborn son to Arthur and Elizabeth Chapman. Elizabeth was a church-going lady who came from a good family who were well-known in town. Both the parents did have some issues with alcohol and drugs. The mother was into pills, sleeping pills specifically, and the brothers would talk about that later as her being sort of disengaged from the family. And Arthur was a drinker who spent a lot of his days at the local VFW post around other veterans from World War II. Would often make his boys, you know, sit in the car and wait while he got drunk all day. And but there was nothing I could find. And other people, you know, who I respect in this investigation believe that Wayne Chapman was absolutely sexually abused. And while I don't discount that, I could never corroborate that, so I didn't put that in the book. What I did find is that Wayne was born in 1947. His parents were married not too soon after, so it was sort of a shotgun wedding. And, you know, Wayne started offending really young. I mean, 4 or 5 years old, he's already touching little boys in the classroom. He's already sort of getting little boys into the woods and doing his best to seduce other young children. He's, you know, asking kids about their bodies. He's getting involved in pornography, finding his father's Playboys and Hustler magazines and showing them around the neighborhood to neighbors. Sort of right off the bat, Wayne Chapman is already thinking down the lines of sexual sort of behavior that, you know, most children, you know, 99.9% of children have no idea what that's even about, you know. So he was exposed to that very young, and he would often state that some classmates of his had sort of got him in the woods and made him undress, and that sort of got him thinking along that track. But I could never corroborate that ever either. You know, he came from a relatively normal family. His father was, you know, he organized neighborhood watches. He was a big member of the veterans community in Jamestown. He was very active in the church. His father was the president of the congregation up there at one point. Wayne was an altar boy. He was named the Youth of the Year in 1964 by his pastor. He was a perfect attendance in Sunday school type of guy. But what Wayne could have never known was that his parents did have some concerns over his behavior as it related to sexual relations with his classmates. He was taking animals into the woods and starving cats, hanging them from trees. He was wetting the bed, and his father was getting, you know, extremely angry that when he was home off the road from his job as a long-haul trucker, Wayne would often be up at night because he peed the bed. And, you know, he's pointed to a specific situation later on where his father threw him out in the snow, and anybody who knows anything about upstate New York knows that, you know, it snows out there in July. I mean, it's brutal up there. And his father would make him stand in snow piles in the middle of the winter naked, you know. And again, you know, my preconceived notion was that I was going to find that Wayne Chapman was nurtured to be one of the worst pedophiles in American history. And I could just never cooperate that, Dan. And in my opinion, you know, Wayne Chapman was a born pedophile. It was a sexual preference for young children. And that started at a very young age, and it was like a snowball as it is. It just starts manifesting. The fantasies happen. He acts out on them, and they just get worse and worse as time goes on, Dan.
Tell us about his high school life. Like, what was it characterized by? What was his... Was he an intelligent guy? Was he a sociable guy? Did he have a lot of friends? Was he athletic? What was he like?
Sure. So Chapman had absolutely no friends. In fact, as he paid no attention to his personal hygiene, which would manifest later in life with losing jobs and actually people, you know, being able to ID him due to his poor hygiene. But the classmates that I could speak to from the late 1960s who were still around, nobody remembered Wayne Chapman. They knew that they had a man who came from their high school, from their town, who was a suspect in multiple child murderers, and it was a prolific child molester, but nobody could tell me anything about Wayne Chapman. Nobody knew him. His brothers, it was a little different. He did have three brothers that came along who, you know, grew up in the same household, same father, same parents, didn't go on to molest children. So Wayne Chapman was, you know, he was somebody who was completely forgettable outside of the bad hygiene and the sort of vacant look that he had that people remembered forever and ever. The most common thread with anybody who's ever met Wayne Chapman that I was able to speak to for this book, whether it be detectives, other offenders, medical staff at state mental hospitals, or people who knew him in Jamestown, would tell you that the guy just was not there. He was a black hole. He was completely vacant in his eyes. He was completely fixated from a very young age on one thing, which was stalking and getting children isolated so he could commit sexual assault. And that was it. He was a pre-programmed machine. Often most pedophiles are, you know, they're circumstantial pedophiles where if they have the opportunity, they will do it. You know, Wayne Chapman was a preferential pedophile, and from a young age that manifested, and he had no social life. He was not involved in sports. His father was a big car guy. He would often, you know, bring his vehicle out into the parking lot and sort of do car shows outside of the house in Jamestown on Linwood Ave where they grew up, which was a quiet street, very close neighbors. He would be tinkering with that car all day. Wayne never had any interest in working with his father. And like most boys do. And you know, by 15, 16, Wayne was already crossing into the Canadian border to indulge in CD sex shops and child pornography. He was already very big into the pornography trade that was sort of underground in Buffalo, in Toronto. And, you know, I was able to corroborate a little bit of that with people up in Jamestown. You know, I had a journalism professor once who told me, you know, it's the best way to get information is to go out there, talk to people on the street. If it's a one-on-one conversation, people are apt to tell you much more. Emails have paper trails. Text messages have paper trails. The conversation that you have with people on the street is only known to the people who are there. And that turned out to be extremely fruitful for me because people talked to me a lot about the general vibe of that area in the 1960s is that you could really indulge in child pornography over the border in Canada. And Chapman later in life would absolutely corroborate that and say he was part of that burgeoning, you know, child pornography consumption and production very early in life in Canada, very close to where he grew up. So that's already where he was fixated, Dan.
When does he run afoul of the law? You say we quit school when he was 16, and then you say he's crossing over the border. He's at the very lower rung of this pornography, child pornography distribution. When does he run afoul of the law? What happens when he's 18?
So 1967, he's in Pennsylvania. And initially in this investigation, Dan, I thought that this guy would wake up in the morning and just throw darts at a state and just head there. But you know, as I've learned later on, as the years gone by into my work with Chapman, is that nothing was by accident, and I hope your audience understands that if they read the book and listen to this, that nothing that happens here is by accident. Chapman must have known somebody in Pennsylvania. He must have had some sort of connection to the Pennsylvania area, in Oil City specifically, because his first offense happens in 1967, and he met a boy the day prior, and he was already beginning to begin with his ruses, you know, the lost dog, the promising of work, and, you know, for whatever reason, he doesn't sexually assault the boy the day that he meets him. My suspicion is that he was stalking him. Chapman would pick out a victim. None of these victims were by accident. And he would fixate on that victim, and he would figure out a way to isolate that boy away from his friend group. He tells the little boy that in August of 67, he tells the little boy, hey, listen, meet me here tomorrow. I have a paper out, you know, and we'll get you working so you can make some money. So Chapman stays there overnight. He actually sleeps very close to where he ends up sexually assaulting the boy in the woods in Oil City. And August night, you know, Wayne Chapman is sleeping in his van overnight with no AC so he can rape a boy in the morning. He takes the boy into the woods. You know, he's asking him pointed sexual questions. At some point, you know, this boy realizes, you know, there's no job. You know, there's going to be no job interview. Chapman ends up, he asks the little boy some pointed sexual questions, and that's enough to get him a corruption charge on the morals of minors. And the boy ends up running away, contacting police. Chapman doesn't even make an attempt to claim that he didn't do anything. At that point in his life, he was very open with police. And, you know, I don't know, because the man, you know, had an IQ sometimes that would top out at around 80, if he just couldn't grasp the seriousness of the crimes. Because in 67, you know, he ends up skating on that. In 1971, he's back in Pennsylvania, and this time he has a 10-year-old boy in Smithport, which is not too far away. It's less than an hour away from Oil City. You know, again, I don't think it's by accident that he ends up in Smithport. He had to have had some connection at that area and seen the boy at a certain point. This time he took the boy out to the wooded area, and he has his camera with him. So I think at this point in 1971, not only is Wayne Chapman molesting little boys, but he's also a low-level child pornography producer, because now the camera comes into it, where he's taking pictures of boys. Boys are making statements to police, you know, he did sexually assault me, and he was taking pictures at the same time. In the 1971 assault, he ends up actually going all the way with this assault, and, you know, the little boy ends up contacting police and describing the vehicle that Wayne Chapman was in. Again, Wayne Chapman is very open with police, and he ends up getting a 1 to 2 year sentence, and he ends up doing 1 year and 5 months in the workhouse. Chapman's worked to death in that workhouse. He's the only sex offender. In the book, I have a picture of the handwritten register of when Wayne Chapman entered the workhouse, and he's in there with people who, you know, assault and batteries, you know, people who have not paid their child support. Of all the pages that I could find, Wayne Chapman was the only person who was convicted of sex offense. So it didn't go well for him in there. And he had talked to guards, and they told him, listen, go out, get straight, you know, stop messing around with little kids, you know, get married, show the world that you can live like a normal person, because this isn't working out for you. Chapman's called a lot of names in the workhouse. He's, you know, old school sort of movie-like prison where you're printing license plates and moving rocks, and he doesn't like it. And, you know, for him, you know, somebody as weak as him, prison is not a good place for him. In late 1960s, they didn't have a special management unit. You know, you were in there, and you were in there in general population, and it was going to be hard for you, even then, as a sex offender, Dan.
Yeah. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these commercials. Now, he's in the workhouse. He realizes now that this is the kind of place he doesn't want to be. He gets out. Does he take this guard's advice? And if he does, what happens?
Yeah, so, yes, he does. And he gets married to a woman named Alice, who is 43 years old at the time, and they end up in Florida for a very short period of time. And of course, Wayne Chapman, you know, had no interest in heterosexual relationships with women. He was a fixated pedophile who was homosexual. And, you know, the main selling point with Alice is that she has two sons, 11 and 14 years old, who Wayne Chapman wanted to test himself to see if he could live amongst children while, you know, not committing offenses. And I'm not sure that Alice had any idea just who she was inviting into her house, because it wasn't long before Wayne sexually assaulted both boys. The boys didn't obviously like Wayne. They didn't believe that, you know, this guy was a good role model or a good stepfather, as you'd imagine. And things don't really go well for Wayne down in Florida. And the boys never came forward. There was no police reports ever filed. There was no police report ever filed by the mother. Wayne Chapman himself admitted later on to molesting both of the boys. And incredibly enough, Dan, you know, as late as 2013, 2014, Alice still kept in touch with Wayne. And it's one of those things, it's a convoluted story with a million convoluted sidebar stories in it here. And I could never quite figure out why Alice continued to support Wayne through, you know, five decades after he had admitted readily that he molested her two sons. It's just one of those things in the story where I'll never quite get a grasp on just what was going on there. And as far as I could find, and I worked hard, you know, to find more victims in Florida, I couldn't find any missing boys during that time frame. And any other victims outside of the two boys. So his small, short time in Florida comes to an end, and he's back up in early 1972. He's back to Jamestown and thinking about his next move. But he remains married throughout his life. Wayne Chapman never got divorced, and he was considered on paper anyway to the Massachusetts Department of Corrections as a married man, Dan.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, you talk about Providence. And you talk about some crimes starting in Labor Day weekend, 1975. What are some of these crimes, and what is it about these crimes that you've included them here and their connection to Wayne Chapman?
Sure. Well, the thing with Wayne Chapman, there's two things that I really needed to figure out in this book was just how a man from upstate New York, Dan, with no connection to Rhode Island, which is, you know, 500 miles away, how he ends up there. You know, at first I thought maybe this was, you know, he's throwing darts at the map, but Wayne Chapman had some connection to Providence, Rhode Island, in the New England area. And I believe the connection is that Providence was a hub, Dan, for the production of child pornography. And in fact, to this very day, if you walk around the city of Providence, you will find the most CD sort of sex shops that exist on almost every street corner. And it all ties back to a man who was part of the mob in those days called Ken Guarino. And he started a company in the late 70s called Capital Video. And that was sort of the early beginnings of CD sex shops in the city of Providence that had existed only in the gay underground at the time. So I believe that was really where Chapman got connected to the city of Providence and why he ended up living some 5 minutes from where I sit right now. Anyways, there were some crimes when Chapman got here, I believe in late 1972, although he was quite quiet for a long time. The missing boys began almost immediately, and the connection to somebody like the 1975 crime was Wayne Chapman had good friends in the state of Maine, which is a northern state closer to you, but still part of the New England sort of cluster here. And a boy went missing in 1975 named Kurt Newton. And Wayne Chapman had talked to Albert Mintz, who was very, very helpful in this book, with very clear memories of everything that had happened decades ago. And he had told me about a time when Wayne Chapman explained to him about a boy that he took in Maine. And he explained the waterfall that he took the boy at, and the boy was at a campground. And just like every other part of this book, Dan, I went up there, and I needed to walk the streets and see the areas. And where Wayne Chapman described he took this little boy was a waterfall that was some 300 yards from the campground where Camp Kurt Newton disappeared. And they never found his body. They never found a shred of him, just his tricycle. There, it remains unsolved to this day. And it just struck me, Dan. I put it in the book. Had I not gone there and seen the site, and Chapman, he relived these crimes forever and ever. I mean, he remembered every last bit of every place that he took a boy. And that would become important as time went on. And it just struck me, as I wrote in the book, Dan, that when I went to that area, I mean, it was just from the police report to what my eyes were seeing was just absolutely perfect in the level of detail. And Chapman was not in the business of admitting to crimes that he didn't do. He was not a bright man. 80 was where his IQ topped out. He was not a master criminal. He was not the type of guy who was going to admit to crimes to throw police off. He didn't have that type of mental capability. So I think that the Kurt Newton disappearance, Wayne Chapman very well may have confessed to that. And much like the other cases, incredibly enough, there's just not enough evidence to ever tie him to it physically.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the same for Douglas Chapman from Alfred,
yes,
Maine as well. And you get to Lee Savoy, a 10-year-old in Revere, Massachusetts. And again, Revere location as well, isn't it?
Yep. Lee Savoy disappears in April of 1974. He fits the victimology of a man like Wayne Chapman and Nathaniel Barjona very closely. Dark features, olive skin. Lee Savoy shines shoes at the racetrack, Suffolk Downs, which exists in Revere, 2 miles away from where the Massachusetts State Police and the FBI busted incredibly large sex ring where boys between the ages of 8 and 17 were being sold for sex in 1977. The police reports that they believe that the sex ring had been going on since the late 1960s. So you're talking about a ring that's maybe 10 years old. And, you know, the Savoy story, much like Lewiston, it's just not a story that is ever covered anywhere in any depth. And nothing of this boy was ever found, not a shoe, not a shirt, anything. And, you know, the public outcry for this case is just, I mean, it's just buried, you know, it's nowhere. And I included the Savoy disappearance in the book because I think it's an important snapshot of the time. This is what was happening in the 1970s in Massachusetts. Boys were disappearing at an incredible rate, and you had men like Nathaniel Barjona, Wayne Chapman, Charles Pierce, who's a necrophiliac carnival worker, who was in and out of town all the time, who had grown up here. They were acting together, and then you have this sex ring that's operating 2.4 miles away from where Lee Savoy disappears off the face of the earth forever. And I think it's an interesting snapshot of the time. But I could never find any evidence to link Lee Savoy to the Revere sex ring or Wayne Chapman or Barjona. I just think it's interesting to note that this is what was happening in the town. And just a month earlier, Dan, at Suffolk Downs, a little boy was sexually assaulted right on the grounds of the racetrack. He was pulled into a bathroom, hand over his mouth, and they tried to take that child and abduct that child, and he was able to get away. So it was happening all the time, Dan, and it's just interesting how it's lost to history now, and it's lost to just the people who lived through it.
You mentioned Nathaniel Barjona, and that's not his real name. Tell us his real name, and then tell us about Nathaniel Barjona.
Barjona was different than Chapman because he was a completely sadistic who got off on terrorizing his victims, frankly, and it was different than Chapman. This guy was smart. He was a master psychopath who could, I mean, some of the feats that he pulled off, manipulating children and manipulating victims, was just incredible, Dan. He was born David Brown in 1957, Worcester, which is a western part of the state. Barjona was 7 years old. He choked a classmate. 12 years old, he tries to kill two little boys in a cemetery who had been picking on him in the neighborhood. He was known as sort of the neighborhood weird kid, came from a decent family. You know, his father and his mother doted on him. His father would eventually become a bit distant, but his mother, until the day she died, really enabled him. His brother and his sister went on to be defense contractors. They owned multiple properties in different states. They were very successful people. They often thought that Nathaniel Barjona, a.k.a. David Brown, was switched at birth. They really didn't believe that he was their brother. He began offending at such a young age, just like Wayne Chapman. And those two, you know, listen, the way these two connected with each other is up for discussion. I know that a PhD named John Espy, who I don't in any way, shape, or form discount his writing, he wrote the definitive series on Barjona. And it was always his assertion that Barjona and Wayne Chapman met stalking kids together sometime in the 1970s. I could never corroborate that as fact. You know, I looking for a picture or some sort of lighting between the two, which could corroborate that so I could put it in the book. But I just could never find that, Dan. But what I could find was Wayne Chapman had admitted to committing crimes in Nathaniel Barjona's town of Webster, Massachusetts. They both used the same MO, which was they dressed as police officers. And those two had been writing letters back and forth well before Bridgewater. And, you know, I mean, no, we're jumping ahead here, but, and they actually stayed in contact with each other when Barjona was released from Bridgewater in 1991 and went to Great Falls, Montana. Those two stayed in contact with each other right up until the end of Barjona's life in 2008. And I do believe that there was a major connection between the two before prison, and they operated together.
Let's get to what happens to Barjona and his sentence and his sexually dangerous designation. And you can explain that. It's a unique Massachusetts edict.
So 1977, Barjona catches two kids coming out of a movie theater in Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. He beats the boys nearly to death. He was to death, and he dumped one body, kept another body in the trunk of the vehicle, which was his mother's vehicle. The little boy who he dumped came back to and called the police and was able to give an accurate description of the vehicle. Barjona was already known to police. Just a week after graduating high school, Dan, he drives up to Connecticut, takes a little girl who he believed to be a little boy who had a short haircut. Once he realized that he had a little boy, he beat that little girl so bad that she defecated, she urinated all over his mother's car. That little girl, even five decades later, Dan, I was able to get in touch with her, and she couldn't even speak Barjona's name. I mean, you just wouldn't believe the damage
Wow.
that this man did to that little girl. And so he didn't get any time for the assault when he was 18, right after high school. Just a couple years later, he's in Shrewsbury. He dumps a little boy's body. He contacts police and gives an accurate description of the vehicle. Barjona is caught a very short time later. He's given an 18 to 20-year sentence in 1977. And he actually goes to Walpole Prison first. He goes to Big Boy Prison, and he finds it to be a terrible experience. In that time frame, Dan, he's writing letters to Wayne Chapman, who is already in Bridgewater. And Chapman is telling him, you got to figure out a way to get over here. It's much better. There's other people here who we know from the outside. It's obviously a much safer place. You're amongst sort of your tribe. And Barjona does get that sexually dangerous designation, which is a Massachusetts edict that, you know, in the layest terms possible I can put it is, if you have no time left on your sentence, but you're designated as a sexually dangerous person from the state of Massachusetts, you can essentially be committed to a state hospital for the rest of your life. And you're allowed to petition every year to get out, which Wayne Chapman and Barjona did, and were denied many, many, many times, but of course eventually got out. But, you know, in the layest terms possible I can put it is, they can keep you for basically as long as you have that designation. And, you know, at the time, Barjona and Chapman wanted that designation so they could get out of Big Boy Prison. But as time went on, Dan, they worked really hard to shed that so they could get out.
Wayne Chapman is convicted of, you say, just not to mince words, but lesser charges than Barjona. How does he get this, again, how does he get the sexually dangerous designation? And how does he end up in Bridgewater? And then when does Jonas, when does Bar-Jonah, and how was he able to get into Bridgewater?
Well, I guess if we're, your first part of your question, we'd have to back up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Chapman is very active in 1974 and 75. He takes two boys in Seekonk, Massachusetts, which is a south coast town of Boston, and he rapes them. Gets away with that. The boys report it. They can never find a suspect. It's a crime that is unsolved. Then he is in Lawrence, Massachusetts, another town that I believe that he had connections in. That is a very tough neighborhood with project kids, and you do not go into that neighborhood and just walk around and look for victims. You would be beaten back with little ease, and I believe Wayne Chapman had major connections to Lawrence. He takes two boys in 1975 in the summer and isolates them in the woods. And, you know, a really heroic point of the story here, Dan, is that he actually fixated on one of the boys and tried to isolate one of them apart from each other. And they wouldn't leave each other because they knew that had they been left alone, Wayne Chapman might kill them. And one boy actually got raped, you know, so he couldn't. So he wouldn't leave his friend. It was an incredibly emotional, heroic part of the story to write, frankly. And, you know, around that time, I believe, is the first time I actually shelved the book and just said I couldn't do this. But anyway, that's just a sidebar. In 75, he commits those two rapes. And then the very next year, in August of 1976, Andy Puglisi disappears. Wayne Chapman is spotted at the pool that day by multiple witnesses. Once they have Wayne Chapman's booking photo and he's a suspect in the Puglisi disappearance, a detective in Lawrence remembers the prior summer and says, I have two rapes that are unsolved. Maybe I should show these boys Wayne Chapman's booking photo. And once he does that, they pick him out of a lineup right away. So Wayne Chapman ultimately ends up in Bridgewater for the rapes of those two boys in 75 August in Lawrence. And that's how he gets his sexually dangerous designation. And that's how he's put in Bridgewater for the sentence of 15 to 30 years and then civilly committed for one day to life, which is how they always do it. I forget the second part of your question, Dan, but that's how Chapman gets the sexually dangerous designation.
Mm-hmm. So now these you contend, and this SB contends, that Bar-Jonah and Wayne Chapman knew each other previously to their stay in Bridgewater. Tell us about Bridgewater and who else joins these two in Bridgewater.
Sure. Well, I try to intertwine some personal stories in the book, and Bridgewater is sort of a personal story for me. It's a place where, you know, when my father was in the picture when I was a kid, we would always fish behind the prison there in Bridgewater. And I would always, you know, I would always sit there and marvel as a young kid at the big towers and the gates. And it's on a sort of a large wooded area, which is well known for paranormal activity. It's called the Bridgewater Triangle, which is quite famous in paranormal circles. I feel like every time I go by there, they're filming something out there, some ghost hunter book or movie. But so I would always be back there, and I remember quite succinctly, as I write in the book, my father telling me, you know, it's creepy out here, but the real creeps are in there, man. So, and I always became, I was always pretty fascinated with that area because you have, you know, a substance abuse center, you have a correctional facility, and then you have the Bridgewater Treatment Center for the Sexually Dangerous. And eventually, Bar-Jonah and Wayne Chapman are behind the walls together. They're joined by another man named Charles Pierce, who I contend as well was quite active with Bar-Jonah and Chapman in the outside world before Bridgewater. And the place has a very sordid history, Dan. It was a subject of a documentary in the late 1960s that documented some really rough treatment of inmates, a place that needed mm-hmm. to be cleaned up and reformed. Massachusetts filed an injunction
making sure that that documentary was actually never released. It wasn't even released until the 1990s. And the deplorable conditions that people had to live under in the 1960s and 70s there was, it's quite galling when you see it. Now the place has been cleaned up, very state-of-the-art. But at the time, Dan, it was a place that wasn't really focused rehabilitation. There were furloughs, there was staff, you know, there was rumors of staff sort of hooking up with inmates. There was family days that they would have at the sex offender treatment center where, you know, there'd be rides and sex offenders, you know, working those rides with people's families. I mean, there's so many bizarre stories that came out of there. And it's sort of a central part of the book is that instead of getting treatment and maybe trying to get these guys right, what they were really doing was getting their PhDs in how to beat cases, you know? Bardona, Pierce, Wayne Chapman, Richard Paluzzo, who was the organizer of the 1977 Revere Ring, was there. Frank Damiano, who was a, and I realize I'm throwing characters at you fast, I apologize, but there's just so many of them, who was a prolific child pornographer, who was a major part of the sex ring was in there. You had Thomas Tripp, who was a serial rapist from this area. I mean, it was really a who's who of predators behind those walls. And Charles Pierce would school Nathaniel Bardona and Wayne Chapman to make sure that if they ever got a chance to get outside the walls again, that they weren't open with police and they denied everything and make sure that there's no body. And those guys really took that to heart, Dan. I mean, for the rest of their lives, after 1977, Wayne Chapman never admitted again to another crime. This was a man who was open with police about just about everything that he had done. And for that, from that day on, he had never been to Lawrence. He had never committed a crime. He went completely radio silent. And it was that PhD that he got that really kind of stopped us from making any headway into any more of these cases. And when Bardona eventually got out, he took all of that to heart because he made sure that when he committed another crime, there was nobody.
Yes. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear from our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. According to Forbes, gyms, nail salons, hotels, mom-and-pop stores, and more are set to go on an epic hiring spree in the coming months to meet the pent-up demand for all of these services. My wife Lisa and I have enjoyed going out to the movie theater again, nightclubs and the gym, and all the other little businesses we would normally shop at. All of these businesses reopening means that millions of jobs will need to be filled. So where do these businesses turn to fill those roles fast? ZipRecruiter. And right now you can try it for free at ziprecruiter.com/murder. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, they send your job to over 100 top job sites, giving you access to their network of millions of job seekers. ZipRecruiter's matching technology scans resumes to find qualified candidates for your open roles and proactively presents them to you. ZipRecruiter's technology is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ziprecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, you just talked about Charles Pierce scolding Bardona and Wayne Chapman and giving them the kind of advice that if there's no body, there's no crime, and no crime, no time. So what happens outside of the prison one day? What's the protest all about? And what's the connection to those three amigos in the treatment center?
So after the Revere sex case had really blown up nationally in 1977, 24 men were indicted, and very few got prison time, and I'm sure we'll talk about it, but the sort of the local gay underground newspapers had really taken up the case. There was a writer named David Brill, who is a fantastic writer who, you know, I disagree with, and I think I say this in the book, I disagree with just about every bit of his assertions, but
he had really taken up the case for the Revere sex ring and basically stated that it was a witch hunt against gay men, that the men really didn't know each other. And that's all complete and utter misinformation, Dan. These men knew each other quite well. All of these boys that were involved in the sex ring were kids just like myself. They were underprivileged kids who didn't have fathers. Some of them have came right from state custody. I mean, these guys were doing, you know, some of the most despicable things that you could ever think of. And for whatever reason, the local sort of gay underground in New England had taken up for them and wrote a series of articles about how it was just essentially a hit job on the gay community. And the men who were involved, you know, sort of on the periphery, were starting to organize a little bit. And, you know, in 1983, protests erupted outside of Bridgewater because a lot of the men who were involved in that Revere sex case behind those walls, like Richard Peluso, who was really the main perpetrator and mastermind behind it. And Barjona and Chapman had actually watched that protest from the day room there in Bridgewater. And it was sort of the early beginnings of, you know, what we would know as NAMBLA, the National American Man-Boy Love Association. NAMBLA started because of the sort of thought that gay men were being, you know, targeted for criminal, you know, cases that weren't really there. And that's really where the formation of NAMBLA began. And there was a man there who claimed to have been there who would show up someday in the 1990s in Great Falls, Montana, you know, a man named Keith Bauman, who you know, was known to Massachusetts at that time and was really starting to organize people, you know, against law enforcement and starting to sort of galvanize the gay community into, you know, hey, you know, we're being unfairly targeted by law enforcement, and we need to sort of gather together and fight back.
Right. So what happens from this, obviously, what happens from this protest, but more about the connection with NAMBLA and these two people, these three people in Bridgewater, and all the defenders in Bridgewater.
Sure. So these men were highly connected to, and I sort of draw the connection between these men and an area in Boston called the Combat Zone, which is a seedy sort of district of Boston that still exists to this day. That was a haven for Navy sailors from the local Charlestown Navy Yard that made ships during World War II. And this was a haven for adult theaters and, you know, adult bookstores where gay men would congregate. And I spent a tremendous amount of time, Dan, in the Combat Zone in the research for this book. And, you know, through all of the times I was interviewing people, and I never knew if I was talking to people who were directly involved, if I was talking to people who were actually, you know, friends with these people and might have even partaken in some of this stuff. And so I had to be very careful on how I talked to them. And really, the beginnings of this ring was sort of fortified right there in those adult cinemas and sex shops and where gay men would congregate and you know, do sexual activities with each other. And it was really a haven for the trade of child pornography, which where they would get together and trade pictures, talk about how they produced it, and, you know, ask each other to get them certain types of pictures. And it's really an incredible, you know, snapshot of the time. And, you know, there was a priest, a man who would eventually become the figurehead for the Boston Globe Spotlight investigation, which became a national news story on the Catholic Church. And this man was Paul Shanley, and he was very well known to the Combat Zone. He would often be outside bars, cinemas, preaching about, you know, how men and boys should be able to, you know, partake in that specific type of love with each other. And he really galvanized the gay community to, you know, think that this was somehow a righteous thing. And Shanley would end up going away for a very long time for lots of molestation cases against young boys.
but he was heavily involved in those days. And these protesters were, you know, more often, more likely than not, you know, they had known Barjona and Chapman and Paluzzo and the like outside of those walls. And the connection between them is, you know, it's hard to overlook, Dan. It's hard to overlook the fact that these guys' activities and existence might have, you know, created the group that would go on to, you know, destroy a lot more lives and really sort of their legacy would live on outside of those prison walls in the manifestation of other boys being abused. And it was right there, Dan. It was right there in Bridgewater at that protest where the NAMBLA group decided to form. And it's just an incredible offshoot to the story. It really is.
Let's get back to one of the real big characters in this book and heroic figures is this Albert Mintz. And also the case of because this is a central part of the book as well as the Andy Puglisi case itself. And you talk about later in the book about a traffic stop in Waterloo with this Mintz and the evidence that's gathered at that time. So go back and let's talk about Lawrence and Andy Puglisi, the crime, and then this Mintz, the confession, and the traffic stop.
Sure. So Puglisi goes missing on 21 August 1976. His girlfriend, his little sort of childhood girlfriend, a woman named Melanie Perkins, ends up going home. Andy says he wants to stay at the pool around 5:30, between 5:30 and 5:45 p.m. The last person to see him was a lifeguard, and eventually the lifeguard fingered Wayne Chapman as the man who was the last person to be seen with Andy Puglisi. Now, Puglisi had been being stalked at that pool for, you know, God knows how long. Chapman had been there the year prior and was convicted eventually of two rapes the year prior. So, and Charlie Pierce was a worked at a Woolworth store, which is in town. So Charles Pierce was well known to the area. He knew the pool quite well. And I believe Charles Pierce was with him on that day and might have helped him move that body because, again, you know, Wayne Chapman was not a smart criminal. So the last person to be seen with Andy Puglisi is Charles Pierce, is Wayne Chapman. Andy is taken out into the woods with Wayne Chapman and his four-year-old friend. So Andy has a four-year-old boy with him at the time. And the four-year-old boy would come in years later and talk of the experience that he last saw Andy as he was running away because Andy, of course, told him, get out of here. You know, I think Andy was starting to understand that this was not, you know, somebody who was looking for a lost dog who needed help because that was the guise that he used. You know, this man had been all over the pool that day asking little kids to help him look for a lost dog, and everybody said no but Andy Puglisi. The little boy had started to run, and when he turned back after cresting a hill, he saw Andy under a large rock with two other men standing over him. And I believe that other man was Charles Pierce because Barjona, if he had been there, as I write in the book, he's a totally recognizable figure. He's 300 pounds. He has a straggly beard. He has two different colored eyes, which is completely noticeable, Dan. Anybody would have been able to pick him out had he been there. And anybody who Googles a picture of Barjona will certainly understand that right away, that he's incredibly recognizable. Charles Pierce and Chapman are really not that recognizable. Now, Chapman walked with a little bit of a limp. He had a scar over his right eye. He didn't pay a lot of attention to his hygiene. He had sort of greasy hair. But these guys were just sort of run-of-the-mill guys. So the last person to see Andy Puglisi alive was his four-year-old friend. Now, of course, they mobilize the full breadth of Lawrence Police Department once they realize that Andy's missing. And, I mean, Green Berets came in from 10 Special Forces Group, which was located at Fort Devens. They mobilized their entire unit. This unit had just been fighting in Vietnam. They'd just done multiple deployments to Southeast Asia. And here they are out there looking for this little boy. Unfortunately, Andy's body was never found. And the only good suspect they had in the case was Wayne Chapman. And Lawrence police had focused a little bit, in my opinion, in retrospect, a little bit too much on the family, including his mother, Faith. She was going through a little bit of drama with her boyfriend at the time. His father lived outside of the home. And it was a typical case, in my opinion, of stranger abduction in retrospect. And, you know, 40 years later, 50 years later, here we are, there's still no sign of Andy Puglisi. So what happens is Chapman leaves that day, and Andy had been wearing a pair of socks that were like knee-high female socks from one of his sisters. Chapman actually had it in the van. What happened, how Albert Mintz gets involved, is that Chapman is driving days later back to Waterloo, New York, and presumably heading home, you know, towards Jamestown. And he's pulled over. Sergeant Tony Vatter, the New York State Police, remembers the license plate from a bolo that very morning that maybe the plate had been stolen. So when they catch Chapman, he's got hundreds of pictures of little boys strewn across his dashboard. And I write this in the book that, you know, this is the way Wayne Chapman existed. I mean, he couldn't take a drive without having pictures of children strewn across his dashboard. So when the police finally make contact with him, they're, of course, struck by the pictures of little boys, and they ask him to exit the vehicle. And he has a starter pistol, and eventually he's taken just on that starter pistol was a weapons violation for the state of New York, even though it wasn't a real gun. When they inventory the vehicle, they find thousands of dollars of state-of-the-art camera equipment. You know, this is a man who worked as a janitor. You know, the median pay was around $350 an hour at the time, Dan. He had state-of-the-art movie reels, all of which depicted young boys in pornographic, had a homosexual activity. He had hundreds upon hundreds of magazines depicting young boys. I mean, he had a mobile child pornography, you know, shop right there. And once they realized that he had a Providence address, and they started trying to identify boys who were in these pictures, Albert Mintz was a sex crimes detective with the Providence Police Department who had not known of Chapman. He received a teletype with the pictures of the boys saying, this man has a address in Rhode Island. We're wondering if you know who this is and who any of these boys are. Mintz is immediately struck by the background in the pictures of the boys. He recognizes it as a major state park here in Rhode Island, Roger Williams State Park, which is a very popular attraction for people in the summer. Mm-hmm. And he immediately grabs a picture and says, well, I know where this is, and I know this is in my town, so I better figure it out. And he immediately gets the name and the address of Wayne Chapman and goes over to his apartment. And he looks around and he, you know, pulls the trash out and gives a general look over the area. He finds receipts and realizes that Chapman's really mobile. He finds receipts in Brockton and Lawrence and Webster, Haverhill, you know, other states, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts. And as he notices a lot of kids out there talking and playing, and he just asks them, you know, if they know anything about Wayne. And immediately the boys start confessing that Wayne Chapman has had them up to the apartment. And immediately he realizes that he's got a case on his hands of a man who's molesting a lot of boys, Dan.
Let's stop for a second for these messages. So how does Mintz proceed with this information?
Immediately he has Wayne Chapman extradited back to Massachusetts. But before he does that, before the extradition comes in, he goes to his boss and says, can I just go up and visit this guy in New York now? Because Mintz now has boys piling into the police station in Providence, telling stories about how Wayne Chapman got him up to the third floor apartment at 129 Linwood Ave in Providence. And, you know, the boys tell him that he has a dark room up there. He's developing film. And Albert's starting to believe that he has a major sex predator here with a multitude of victims. And once he starts looking at the receipts, he's realizing that just a week ago, this man was in Lawrence. We have a missing boy in Lawrence. We have a missing boy in Brockton. He's aware of all these cases. So he wants to check and make sure, you know, that Wayne Chapman doesn't know anything about these other missing boy cases. So he brings the pictures along with him. He does get clearance to go up to New York, and he goes up to upstate New York in Waterloo and has the first series of interviews with Wayne Chapman, where the crimes sort of come into better focus. He tells him, you know, that he had talked to a lot of the boys in Providence, and a lot of them were Italian kids. And you have to understand, Dan, that growing up in this area, in Rhode Island and Boston area, nothing happened. No commerce happened without the mob being involved. And
right.
In Boston, you had the Irish mob of James Lighty Bulger. In Providence, you had the La Cosa Nostra, you know, Raymond Patriarca mob. And even more than the police, they had power, you know, more than anybody. They ran every enterprise there was. Plays off that with Chapman. He tells them, listen, you have sexual assaults on a bunch of Italian boys. How do you think this is going to play in prison? And he knows that Wayne Chapman is petrified of going to prison because he's had bad experiences in the past. He's probably going to go away for a long time. So Mintz tells him, just be honest with me, and I can see what I can do for you, because I think you belong in a hospital and not in prison. And obviously Chapman is thinking, you know, if I can get to a hospital, things are probably going to be a little bit better for me. Sorry, Dan. So they talk. He shows them pictures of David Lewison, the 5-year-old boy from Brockton who is missing. And Chapman immediately starts to confess that that's the boy that he took behind the cemetery, Melrose Cemetery in Brockton, which would have been about 2.8 miles away from where David Lewison went missing. He shows them the Puglisi picture, and he says, you know, that looks like the boy that I took with another boy. And at the time, Dan, the police did not know that another boy was involved when he took Puglisi. Right. That boy had not come forward until 6 years later. The only people who could have known that were the people who were there. And he explains and describes the salt pits in Lawrence where the abduction took place. And Al, I mean, even decades later, Dan, tell me, you know, the minute I actually viewed the scene in Lawrence after the conversation, I knew that Wayne Chapman had killed Puglisi, because he said it was just to a T how perfect it was. And obviously now it looks a lot different, so it's very hard for me to have reference. But at that point, Wayne Chapman had confessed to victims in Fall River, Massachusetts, Seekonk, Connecticut. He had talked about his crimes in Virginia in 1968 when he had went, you know, quiet for a long time, where he tied a boy to a tree who bit him and lit the boy on fire. And he thought that the boy had died. And that was one thing that I chased down in the story for years and years, Dan, was trying to locate a missing boy in Virginia between 1968 and 70 who might have been found tied to a tree. And I just, you know, I chased that story forever, but I've never been able to verify it. But if Wayne Chapman, you know, I'm of the mind that if Chapman, you know, confessed to it, then it happened, because he was not, again, in the business of trying to throw police off the scent. He was just simply not a smart enough man to play games with police. So it was during those first rounds of interviews, Dan, that Al Mintz was able to get the quasi-confessions on the Lewison Puglisi case, all the rapes in Providence and the surrounding areas. And Mintz was starting to get some sort of focus on just how many victims this man had.
You talk about a crucial interview and the skill that you, well, you just described somewhat. It's a skillful interview to be able to persuade this person to give up information that other people would have a hard time eliciting from him. What happens with the evidence, the clear evidence from this confession? What can happen from it?
Yeah, you would think, you know, this was the end of the story, right, Dan? That, you know, the bad guy confesses and leads people to the bodies and the family gets some sort of, yeah, I don't know how, if you could call it closure. Yeah. I don't know what you could call it, but But it's not. I mean, Wayne Chapman describes these crimes in great detail. Albert Mintz does an incredible job, in my opinion, of pulling it out of him. And, you know, at one point, he even blurts out when Mintz is putting some pressure on him, you know, I killed the kid, okay? I killed him. You know, he says that about Andy Puglisi. And just as, you know, Albert is starting to make some headway, you know, and I didn't put this in the page to disparage anybody, but Albert Mintz is absolutely livid at his partner who came down with him from Providence because he believes that he cost him the entire case at that point. Mind you, this is not Albert Mintz's case. He is not a Lawrence police detective. He's not a detective from Brockton. He is investigating Providence crimes. But he is trying to get a full breath of what Wayne Chapman has done while living in Providence. And he has him on the hook for maybe a full-scale confession to two missing boys who have haunted the region for years in one case. His partner sort of interjects and says, hey, you know, fine, we killed him. Let's get a full-scale confession. Tell us about it. And at that point, Wayne Chapman shuts down and says, hey, you got me believing my own lies. And Al Mintz, you know, to his eternal credit, you know, to this day, you know, as he sits in sunny Jacksonville, Florida, where he lives now, says, you know, that was the worst, you know, that was the defining moment in our cases because we lost Wayne Chapman right there. And he never, ever again admitted to a crime. I mean, as from that point on, Wayne Chapman had completely shut down, and Albert Mintz lost him, and he, you know, did the best he could with, you know, trying to play on his, you know, the sort of what his life would be like in prison, and he better be honest, but I think something clicked in his mind where if I made a full-scale confession, I could potentially, you know, maybe be looking at, you know, life in prison, you know, in Walpole, which is a notoriously tough prison here, Dan. He could not get the death penalty. We just out here. So I don't know what happened. I'll never know, you know, in his psyche. But at that point, Wayne Chapman shut down, and the evidence now had to be, you know, detectives now had to focus on getting physical evidence and tying Wayne Chapman to the crimes, and that it was just never available because the bodies were never found. And, you know, there was just no physical evidence ever linking Wayne Chapman to David Lewison or Andy Puglisi. It died right there, Dan.
Let's get back to Bridgewater and Charles Pierce counseling these guys, no body, no crime, no time. Bar-Jonah has a brother who has some money. And very much like Wayne Chapman, these guys, of course, find Christianity in prison. Tell us what happens with Bar-Jonah and the sexually dangerous designation?
Well, Bar-Jonah's brother, Bob Brown, who would often state that he believed his brother was switched at birth, was really one of his ultimate enablers, Dan. And as we go on in the story, you'll understand it even more. But, you know, basically, Bar-Jonah was looking at getting out of prison very shortly on his prison time. He had only gotten 18 to 20 years with the Massachusetts parole system. I mean, he could have seen himself out, you know, by 1987, and he was trying to shed that sexually dangerous designation that he fought so hard to get, ironically, and he wanted his brother to find him some Christian psychologists, and he found them. He wrote a $5,000 check to basically pay to get his brother out of prison, and these two men, Eric Schweitzer and Richard Ober, came in and totally disregarded every, you know, the staff at Bridgewater had been evaluating Bar-Jonah all along, and they considered him to be one of the most dangerous predators that they ever had behind those walls. They had recommended that Nathaniel Bar-Jonah never, ever see the light of day. This was a man who would openly speak about, you know, just to give you a snapshot of his prison, you know, his Bridgewater time, this was a man who would carry pictures of kids in his Bible, and they'd fall and drop out. He did not participate in sex offender treatment at all. He had no interest in trying to, you know, figure out why he committed crimes. He had often talked to psychologists about his, you know, his sort of curiosity about what it would be like to taste human flesh. I mean, he was openly opining about his interest in becoming a cannibal. And these two men came in, evaluated Bar-Jonah, basically in a nutshell, testified in front of the judge
in early 1990 that, hey, listen, you know, this guy has found Christianity. He has a plan to move to Montana. You know, he had started an antique business, you know, from prison. You know, I don't know how they do that, but that's great, you know. Board games. He had patented a couple of board games that he was trying to get sold, and the judge bought it. I mean, the judge didn't blink an eye, and Nathaniel Barjona was the door was open, and his mother was waiting for him in, you know, August of 1991. He was a free man on the recommendations of a man like Richard Ober, which, you know, I read in the book, Dan, you know, this was a guy who, you know, was a Marine who had taught school children in Da Nang province in Vietnam. He was a man who was a well-respected member of the church. His practice, his private practice, was literally located a stone's throw from where I live on the south coast of Massachusetts. I would often run by there on my running route almost every day. And there were so many times, as I write in the book, where I wanted to just talk to him. And I would see him getting out of his vehicle and heading into his practice. And, you know, I couldn't tell you how many times, Dan, I wanted to just stop him and, you know, obviously respectfully, and just say, could we please, you know, understanding what we know now about what Barjona did after he got out of prison, I'm just not sure how this man sleeps at night. You know, I'm not sure. And, you know, in 1991, Barjona is a free man, completely no parole, no prison, no probation. He is absolutely let go from Bridgewater just months after opining about the fact that he had some interest in the taste of human flesh. It's an incredible story. It's unreal. It's almost too unreal to be true. But, you know, I've read the court documents, Dan. It's absolutely true. That's how he got out.
What does he do? You just mentioned that he reoffends almost immediately. What does he do? What crimes does he commit?
43 days later, he's in a town of Oxford, Massachusetts. Boxford. And he sees a little boy in the back seat of a vehicle, and his mother is heading into the post office, and it's in a rainstorm. He's out on one of his many walks. A very key thing for Barjona was to get out and walk around the streets and, spy little kids, take pictures. That was one of his big things. And, you know, the mom had left a kid in the back seat of the car, 7-year-old boy. Barjona opened the door and proceeded to jump up and down on the boy's chest. Now, at this point, Barjona was pushing 325 pounds. This boy was 3'8" and around 35 pounds. And he stomped on the boy's chest and just furiously acted out, and which was absolutely his M.O. I mean, he was sadistic, and he got off on other people's pain. And thank God the mother saw it in time and was able to come outside and grab Barjona out of there, who, of course, was just simply saying, you know, I wanted to get out of the rain. He made a million excuses. He turns around, runs off. The mom is able to give him an accurate description to the police. And, of course, Barjona is so well known, even all these years later. Police remembered the description of the man from 1977, the two abductions that took place. So they end up over at Barjona's mother's house that day. They take him in, and, you know, incredibly, Dan, it happens time and time again in this story. He gets off. I mean, there's nothing really. He's not kept in prison that night. He's basically referred to probation, and he's out within hours. And that very night, he looks up the victim's name from the police report. You know, back then it was, you know, Yellow Pages or whatever. But he takes a cab to the victim's house that very night, and they see him pulling up the driveway. They shut all the lights off. He tells the cab driver, wait right here. He stands outside the house and just peers in so everybody can see him, and then just turns around and walks off. But the message was sent, Dan. You know, this was a guy who absolutely everything that, you know, pedophile, absolutely, you know, but his main thing was terrorizing his victims. He got off on the terror. And that very night, after doing, you know, 15 years in Bridgewater, he's right back to terrorizing victims. He just couldn't stop himself.
And he left that night. He ended up having a court appearance in the preceding weeks. And they were, you know, he'd gone in front of a different judge, and they were ready to throw him back in there for life. I mean, they didn't know what to do with this guy. You know, he was a guy who, you know, was cunning enough to tell them, listen, you know, I'm getting ready to leave the state. I'm heading to Montana with my parents. His brother Bob had already been a defense contractor who owned a lot of property in the Montana area, so he was known to him. And Massachusetts authorities, for whatever reason, agreed to do that. And they said, listen, you know, two conditions. A, Montana's got to take you, so you've got to get in contact with them. And B, you need to have a psychological exam today. And Barjona walked out of the court that day, never went down to psych, and also never contacted authorities in Montana. He was heading to Montana, you know, just a mere week later. So Montana had no idea that he was coming, and Massachusetts had no idea that he'd never contacted them. So it was a major misstep and major miscommunication that would, you know, eventually, you know, allegedly cost a boy's life.
Let's stop for a second for these messages. You talk about it cost a boy his life. While he's out, of course, his friend Wayne Chapman is jealous. What does he do to join his friend on the outside and continue their crimes on the outside?
To be clear, excuse me, Wayne Chapman had two 15 to 30-year sentences to serve. So he had about at least 30 years at the very least to serve, but he was starting to see the end of his time too. Not sure who paid for it, Dan. You know, these are not real psychologists. These are just simply hired guns who will do whatever you tell them to do for the right price.
Sure.
But Chapman was able to get Ober and Schweitzer to, he had essentially done the same. He stopped going to treatment. He had stopped doing anything to sort of better himself. He would never talk about his crimes. I had talked to tons of people who were staff at that time, and Wayne Chapman was just shut down. I mean, he would never, ever talk about anything as related to his crimes. He never took responsibility. He didn't have the capability to understand, you know, what he had done. And Ober and Schweitzer eventually testified to the fact that Wayne Chapman is himself no longer sexually dangerous. And you look at the totality of Wayne Chapman's crimes, you know, 100 victims that he admits to, God knows how many more, you know, the missing boys. And, you know, the fact that somebody would good conscience testify that this man may not be a threat to society is just, it's unfathomable for me. And if you read this book, there's not really, you know, many happy endings. There's not a lot of stuff that's redeemable here. And this is one of those instances. It's just, it's maddening. But it does shed, they do shed Wayne Chapman of his sexually dangerous designation. And he gets sent from Bridgewater to Gardner, which is another sort of low, medium prison in Massachusetts. And at the time, he's in contact with Barjona through snail mail. And, you know, he's talking about the outside and what Wayne Chapman can do to get out of there. And they remain in pretty consistent contact all the way through the 1990s and right up until Barjona's death. I know we're jumping ahead, but those two, you know, had often talked about many, many things, including, you know, sort of some cryptic messages back and forth that nobody's ever really been able to understand what exactly they're talking about. But those two were the best of friends, and Wayne Chapman was incredibly jealous that Ober and Schweitzer were able to get him out of there. But, you know, his sentence was a lot lighter because he just didn't have the totality of crimes that Wayne Chapman did.
You write about 1996 and a character named Doc Bowman and Barjona. Tell us who Doc Bowman is and what happens in 1996 regarding a 10-year-old boy, Zach Ramsey.
There's so many rabbit holes in this case, Dan. You know, and Doc Bowman is a rabbit hole that I fell down, you know, for years. And you know, the thing that really got me on Bowman is that he was known to Massachusetts in the 1970s. And this is a man who had been committing sexual assaults against children for decades. He was a legitimate doctor. He had a PhD from Houston. He was a piano teacher in the 1960s in Colorado who would put out ads in the paper for lessons for special youngsters. And this man had been committing crimes in Colorado throughout the entire 1960s. And eventually was, you know, most pedophiles, he was ran out of town, and the details are incredibly unclear. But he ends up allegedly in Massachusetts in the 1970s. He had stated many times that he was a member of the Original 32, which is what the Original 32 members of NAMBLA call themselves.
Right.
I was never able to corroborate that. He had no address history in Massachusetts, no known associates. But I believe, you know, this was a place, Dan, that was a pedophile safe haven in the 1970s. I mean, people were coming in from all over the country, Atlanta, California, you know, Midwest, you know, to patronize a sex ring and sort of, you know, get with like-minded people. 99% of the public is repulsed by what these people have inside them. They look for validation. And somehow he ends up in Great Falls, Montana, which is, you know, again, you know, those details are murky too, but I would not be surprised, and I talk about it in the book, that Barjona and Doc Bauman didn't know each other ahead of time, and maybe some intelligence came through back channels that this is a safe place to be. You know, there was another pedophile from Massachusetts that I talk about in the book, Keith Donaldson, who lived very close to Barjona, and he was a sex offender against little boys, and that was his main thing was little boys, and he had been convicted on sexual assault, and he ends up in Great Falls, Montana, never living more than a mile away from Barjona, and he's a Massachusetts guy all the way who had never been there. So it's just bizarre. It's from the, you know, I just take it from the basis of there are no coincidences in the story, because there isn't. There's always a reason behind why these people are where they are and who they victimize. So Doc Bauman ends up meeting Barjona in 93 in Montana. He's got a long history of sex crimes against children. He's a Korean War vet who had saw a good bit of combat as a medic. And at that point in his life, he's in his late 60s. And he sort of, him and Barjona sort of band together, much like Chapman and Barjona did years prior. And they stalk children together. They walk the streets of Great Falls together and take pictures, you know, over by the schools and the malls. And those two are basically inseparable all the way up until Barjona, Zach Ramsey, goes missing. And, you know, the thing with the Ramsey disappearance is this, is just before Ramsey disappeared, Doc Bauman had a plan to take him away to Canada. These three were in sort of a lover's quarrel together. Doc Bauman had fallen, you know, completely in love with this 10-year-old boy. And Barjona was incredibly jealous that he was spending less time with Zach and he was with Bauman more. So I believe that was the genesis of Barjona's anger towards Zach Ramsey. And I believe that's what ultimately led to his disappearance, Dan.
Mm-hmm. You write in 1999, Barjona is arrested. He's given 130 years for molesting neighbors. The detectives read his correspondence between himself and Wayne Chapman. And so they, you say that Montana authorities believe that Barjona and Wayne Chapman may have killed kids for years together. So this other team up. So let's talk about 1999, but also Charles Pierce, we mentioned him already. What does he say on his deathbed regarding Andy Puglisi?
Yeah, Charles Pierce ends up with prostate cancer, and he's really near the end in 1999. He had confessed prior to murders. Charles Pierce made it a habit, Dan, of confessing to murders all the way throughout his criminal career. Now, this was a man who was a carnival worker who had been living all over the country, but he was born in Massachusetts. And he caught a case in Florida in 1979 where he molested two boys, and he immediately confessed to the murder of a young girl named Janice Pocket in Connecticut in 1979, which I write about in the book. And I sort of, you know, ask the question of, you know, Connecticut authorities don't believe that Charles Pierce did that murder. They believe that he just simply confessed that murder so he could get to Massachusetts to be behind the walls of Bridgewater with his friends, which, you know, Florida prison system is notoriously tough, and it's definitely not easy for a pedophile. So I could see that, you know, there's alternate theories there. But on his deathbed in 99, he starts admitting that he, you know, that he committed these murders in Lawrence, that he, you know, buried the body of Andy Puglisi, and, you know, and then he pulls back, and then he does it again. I mean, he goes back and forth, but, you know, I do believe, you know, Dan, like I said, I believe when Wayne Chapman took Andy Puglisi on that day in 1976, he intended to do what he always did, which was rape the boy and take pictures so he could produce his child pornography and get it out to his customers. He was a low-level child pornographer who was at the bottom rung of a massive apparatus, and it's really the apparatus that killed these boys. That being said, I think things got out of hand, and Andy Puglisi was somehow killed in the commission of those crimes. And once he realized that he had a dead boy on his hands, that's when men like Charles Pierce get involved. And Charles Pierce was made it be known in those circles that if a body needed to go away, he could make it go away. Now, whether they took that body and buried it somewhere in Lawrence that we have yet to find yet, I truly hope that's the case, and someday his remains get returned to his family and his family have a place to, you know, lay flowers or visit their son. It's, you know, the opinion of some authorities in Providence, and in my opinion as well, that somehow those two got back to Providence where Chapman was employed at Miriam Hospital, where he had the key to the incinerator. There was an unauthorized burn that very next day. Chapman was at work when he wasn't supposed to be, and I believe that's what they did with Andy Puglisi's body. And I believe the reason why a guy like Pierce would admit to a crime like that on his deathbed was simply just to run misdirection for his friend. He was about to die. Chapman had years left. And, you know, if he could screw with the police one last time, then great. And that's what I truly believe that was. And I don't think that he's the one who, you know, killed Puglisi, but I do believe that he had a lot of involvement in what happened afterwards. And witnesses had stated in the years that have gone past now that they saw a van that looked just like Charles Pierce's idling near the pool that day. And I believe Pierce was there that day. They worked in tandem. And whether it was, you know, Wayne Chapman committing the crime and Charlie Pierce taking the pictures or what have you, I believe Charles Pierce was there that day and had some sort of involvement in the crime. And the confession is layered in some truth, but not all the way true, Dan.
You write that in 2018, Wayne Chapman was released living outside of a school in a nursing home in Rocky Hill, Connecticut. And you had a brief confrontation with him in 2019. Tell us about that.
You know, I heard a great true crime author named James Renner. I heard him on a podcast, you know, maybe 2-3 years ago, talking about how he had a favorite suspect in a case that he had been obsessed with for years, the disappearance of a girl named Amy Mihalovich. And he had said that he had gone down to Florida, and he basically was going to call the man's bluff and say, hey, I have this information, and see how he reacted. And I sort of stole a page from his book. If I ever had the opportunity, I told myself to talk to Wayne Chapman, I was going to tell him that I had information that I know that he committed an unauthorized burn the very next day after Andy Puglisi's disappearance. And I wanted to see his reaction. Dan, I don't have that information, but I wanted to see his reaction. Although it is the opinion of the detectives in Providence that that's what happened. And I think that's a good theory. I think that's a theory that makes a lot of sense, but I don't know. Either way, I saw a news report that Wayne Chapman was going to be released to a homeless shelter that was close to the Boston area that I recognized, and I knew that Chapman would probably enter an exit in certain directions, and I was going to go down there and talk to him. And, you know, I grabbed him, and he was in his wheelchair at that time, and I said, you know, Wayne, I know that, you know, I have information that Andy Pugliese's DNA was found in the incinerator, and what do you think of that? And, you know, he just told me that he had never been to Lawrence, and he doesn't know anything about it. He denied until it was a meeting that was completely fruitless, but I'll tell you, Dan, I've been in front of Taliban terrorists in Afghanistan and Iraq. I've been in front of Boko Haram terrorists in the Middle East. And I've been in front of the worst people that you could possibly produce in this world, and I've never had the feeling that I had when I was face-to-face with Wayne Chapman. He's just the definition of pure evil and an unfinished soul, you know. He's just he doesn't have the capacity to feel the feelings that me and you feel. And I took at least that away from the meeting.
Yeah. I want to thank you, David McGrath, for coming on and talking about Monster, The Life and Crimes of Wayne Chapman. There is so much more to discover for people to read in this book. We've just touched on it in this 90 minutes. For those that might want to take a look at this, tell us when this release date is, and is there a Facebook page or anywhere where people might take a look at this more, and if anything else, that they might be able to find you on social media?
Yeah, you can certainly find me on Twitter at DavidMcGrath11B. Dan, if I could, I would like to my email address is DavidMcGrath11B as in Bravo at gmail.com. Anybody who listens to this who's triggered, who has been a victim of sexual assault, or please, you know, feel free to email me. I'm always here to listen. You know, this book is because of my own sexual abuse, and these stories cannot be lost to time. And there's great people who do work on this, like Melanie Perkins, and I'm sort of picking up the mantle a little bit too. But the bottom line is, we can't let these things get lost to history. Statistically, Wayne Chapman exists in your neighborhood right now. And for whatever reason, it's just these are crimes that we don't talk about in public. And I hope that this book can do a little bit to change that. And if there's somebody out there who's dealing with fallout from their own sexual assault, then please email me. Get in contact with me. I'm always here. And I'd like to make that point above all, Dan.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much, David McGrath. Monster, The Life and Crimes of Wayne Chapman. Released November 11th. So thank you so much. You have a great evening. And thank you so much for this interview.
Thanks, Dan.
Good night.